Happy Shabbat, everyone. Welcome to Yada Yah Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We've got, if I could click his switchboard, we have Mr. 904 in Jacksonville, Florida. We have Larry with us. I'm going to get you up live here momentarily. Hello, Larry.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm doing good. Doing good.
It's just
a little light rainstorm. It's pretty nice, really.
Oh, well, good. Yeah, it actually cools down a little bit there in northern Florida when it rains.
Well, I just keep the AC on all the time, so I don't notice the difference. But there is a little light rain out there.
Okay. We were talking in the chat room before the show about the Shattering Myths program today. It was one of the really enjoyable ones. In fact, the entire time it was dialogue. We began with IQR Rasuli, which is typical for Fridays. We have been rather passionate here these last few weeks, maybe even 5 or 6 weeks, because of the just horrid nature of Boko Haram and the fact that nobody knows what to do with them because they're so adroitly fundamentalist Muslims and they have absolutely no connection to Al-Qaeda. So the world just doesn't want to deal with them. They want to put them in a corner over there because they know they're acting like good Muslims and their behavior is so criminal.
Would have criminal behavior, sure.
Yeah, and it's it's something both of us are really passionate about because the what they're doing to those women, and then going into a town and screaming Allahu Akbar and killing every man and boy, and then burning the entire village. The world needs to come to the point where it says no more. Islam has pretended to be a religion long enough. It's time we say goodbye. This stuff is this is not acceptable.
Do you want to take any bets on the world coming together saying that?
About zero. Zero, because the world doesn't have a collective conscience. Amongst all the leaders of the world could combine their conscience, and you couldn't come up with one functioning unit. By the way, your favorite institution, Larry, was
which one?
Dish today, the Roman Catholic Church.
Oh, okay,
The Roman Catholic Church. We know had the first episode in Ireland with the Roman Catholic Church was the their schools, and about 3 years ago discovered that 30,000, not 30, not 300. Not 3,000, 30,000 young boys and girls, mostly young boys, were sexually abused in Roman Catholic schools in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's the largest case of Roman Catholic pedophilia ever. And then shortly thereafter, it was...
You mean ever caught, but...
Ever
yeah,
caught.
Okay.
Yeah, ever caught.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, ever
yeah.
caught. I would go along with that. I stand corrected. 30,000 is a lot, particularly
and
for
now. They
country.
Got the mass grave over there too.
The next thing was the Madeleine laundries, and the Madeleine laundries where they took in allegedly wayward women, and they turned them into slaves, and they beat them and they mistreated them, and the stories that have come out of the torture that was perpetrated by the Roman Catholic Church in these laundries was just horrific. And
like 35,000 of them, wasn't it?
Something yeah, and that was the next issue that dropped. But yesterday, it was discovered that there are at least 80 and probably many more infant corpses in a cesspool.
I read 800.
Oh, is it 800? Yeah, maybe it is. It's 800. 800 infant corpses in a cesspool that were discarded by another one of the Catholic homes for unwed mothers. They starved these babies to death.
Yeah, and the archbishop over there, Neri, said that he was, quote, shocked. He was shocked.
I read the comments on the website after the story had been presented, and one idiot had the audacity to say, you know, we can't jump to conclusions and blame the institutionalized church. You know, this is not part of their policy, and we should be looking at those people who did wrong. And you want to say, you know, what in the world, you despicable soul, trying to defend this repulsive institution. Fortunately, about 500 people climbed down his throat and said, yeah, I'm an ex-Catholic, and I'm an ex-Catholic because after about the 5,000th report of pedophilia amongst priests, I decided I wasn't going to go there anymore, and I most certainly wasn't going to send my children there. And so, you know, if you can't figure out that the Roman Catholic Church is the source of the problem and that they cover up the problem, then, you know, you really ought to get a brain.
Well, you know, I work for Gallup. And back when I worked for Gallup, they did a survey among people going into the priesthood. And 55% just flat out admitted they were homosexual. 55%.
Yep. And by the way,
that admitted it. Just
you and I might have a different view on this. I don't care if somebody's homosexual or not. I do not care. It doesn't matter to me what you want to do in your own private life. I don't care if you are a homosexual. I don't even care if you get your jollies doing lammies. It really doesn't. Your choices are your choices. All I care about is my relationship with my father and with my family and the extended family of the covenant. That's really all I care about. And those people who want to know him, great, we'll talk to you. If you want to be out and do something stupid, that's up to you. But
No, this was not, you know, by the way, I mean, I don't care either. But we do care,
to a point, which is when
you start shoving it down other people's throats.
We hate it. Yeah, we hate it.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, if a bunch of heterosexuals had a parade, you know, headlining their sexual proclivities in their bedrooms,
right,
they would look stupid, okay?
Right. It would be repulsive.
By the way, my
issue with a Roman Catholic priest being homosexual is manyfold. One is, why in the world do you have the title father when Yahusha said, don't call anyone on earth father? But why would you call yourself a father, A, if you're a homosexual? You've never been married. You don't have a family. And also, if they're prone, which far too many priests are, to exercise no restraint on their homosexual tendencies and abuse little boys.
No, that was kind of my point there, you know.
Yeah.
And 55% of them just outright, you know, owning it when they're going into the priesthood. It should tell us something, you know.
Yeah, it's the perfect environment for them to prey on little boys. It's just like so many men go into the military knowing that it's the perfect environment for them to sexually abuse women because it's less than 1% that are held accountable. So, I mean, if they continue to get promoted, as a matter of fact. So it's we have problems, both institutions. You've got to be absolutely out of your mind to be
Catholic. First of all, I think anybody running around playing like they're a religious head of anything has probably got, you know, he's a snake. I mean, we see it. We see the pastors and all these churches, you know, having affairs and every other thing. So, you know, and half of the youth ministers are out there, they're child molesters as well. So, I mean, you know, it's something you're going to find in religion. I mean, they're
right.
Snakes. I mean, they're described as snakes.
Yeah.
They're
promoting something that they themselves know is not true.
But it's hard to imagine that you can't attack an institution that's it's not just 800 little babies starved to death out in a septic tank. It's
that's pretty bad. I mean, on a 1 to 10 scale of bad, I mean, that's an 11.
It is. And you have the same thing with the Native American population orphans up in Canada. You had the same thing, mass graves and all this, and with the Catholic Church tied to it. Everyone knows that it goes on, it's went on, and how anybody can even think to defend such, I mean, that's ruthless behavior.
I can't wait to share the study I've done on Rome, because it really shows the birth of Christianity within the Roman Empire. And of course, if I were to ask you, Larry, can you name for me the single most influential Roman of all time? Who would that be?
I would say Constantine.
Yeah, no, I'd ask you just for all time, who is the single most influential Roman?
Because I'd say Constantine. No?
Nope.
Who would you say?
You know, what's interesting about Constantine, I would have said that too 9 months ago. Constantine is an interesting choice. But, you know, Constantine did not make Christianity the official religion of Rome. He never himself
he
converted
the
to Christianity.
Sun right to
and,
the
as a matter of fact, that whole episode of seeing the sign of the cross emblazoned before the sun never happened.
Oh, really?
Never happened. No,
who made that one up?
Eusebius. Eusebius was his
historian.
Propagandist. Constantine never mentioned it. The first battle that's supposed to have the Rocai or Cairo and all of the shields never happened.
Really?
And then that never happened. And then and Constantine was a disgusting, violent, ruthless, money grubbing, egomaniac. I mean, he was what a horrible human being. Anyway, he no mention of any of this. And then Eusebius writes a book about him, and he doesn't mention it in the book on Constantine when he's trying to promote Christianity. And then he writes his second book on Constantine, and the story appears there. And the story is clearly one that has been made up because it is wholly inconsistent with the historical account. So no, it never actually occurred. I didn't know that until recently. And Constantine, the Edict of Milan, was not to make Christianity the official religion of Rome. In fact, Constantine wasn't even the most liberal in terms of legalizing the Christian religion. There were many emperors prior to him that were much more aggressive in legalizing Christianity than Constantine. The Edict of Milan, it said, you can worship any god you want. You pick your god, we don't care. All gods are good, and you can worship any god you want to. There no longer shall be any persecution against any religion other than if you're a Jew, you can't worship your god. That god's still illegal. But every other god's good to go. That was the Edict of Milan.
Now, I believe that.
Yeah. And then
so who would you say is the most influential?
Well, I'll answer the question just 1 second, because I want to say one more thing about Constantine. And I know that this program is focused on let's present the Torah, but we have, as a family, I believe we have a number of responsibilities. One is to continue to be part of our own voyage of discovery so that we come to know Yahweh better, we come to understand what he's offering better. But part of that is not just for our own personal edification. Part of that is so we can share what we've learned.
Yeah, clearly. And you have to know where the corruptions come from.
Right, correct. Yeah. And to be an effective witness today, and I think that's a huge part of our job. I think it's the reason why I'm beginning to even think that I had the date of the harvest of Terua wrong, and I'll speak to that in a moment. I think I'm wrong by 3 years, maybe even 3.5 years, but 3 years I think I'm wrong. But our purpose is to be witnesses, because God, you know, more people should take advantage of what Yahweh has to offer, and the bigger the family is, the more exciting eternity is going to be. We're not shortchanging ourselves by adding to the family. We're making eternity even richer. And so that is our job. And for most of us who live in cultures, whether it be Australia or New Zealand or in Canada or America or in England, where the
Commonwealth
English
of Dominica.
Where English is the primary language, Christianity is the primary adversary. So when we expose it, I think this kind of preparation is an important part of this program, because we want to be more effective sharing what we know about Yahweh. Now, the one thing that Constantine did that had a huge influence on the world, and so I would put Constantine as the third most influential Roman of all time. He presided over the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
By the way,
that's exactly,
you know what
the
Nicene Creed means, sir?
No, I know what they did there, but...
Okay.
No.
Nicaea is named after the Greek god of victory. There's a shoe company named after him, too, called Nike.
Okay.
So the Nicene Creed is actually the creed of the Greek god of victory. wonderful, huh? You just got to love Christianity. The purpose of the Nicene Creed is Arius had a large following of people who knew that Yahusha was not the totality of God. They knew that Paul was not telling the truth when Paul said that the fullness of the Godhead resided on him bodily. They knew it was impossible for all of God to reside in a man. And they knew that his whole presentation of who he was designed for us to look through him to the Father, and not to look to him as if he was the totality of God. God was there in heaven. He was the Father. And so Arius knew that. And so they were called Arians who recognized the truth that you can't make a religion around Yahusha, because his own testimony of who he is won't allow it. And
right.
Yahweh's
all the
testimony
leading up to it doesn't allow it.
Yeah, won't allow it. Yeah, so you can't do it. But so for Constantine and the new Church of Rome to establish Christianity as a religion, with the Roman animosity towards Jews, I mean, at this time, the Torah is illegal. Every copy of the Torah is burned. The Torah is illegal. Circumcision is illegal. Hebrew is illegal because of Hadrian, and Greeks universally despised Jews because of circumcision. They thought, because you know the Jews the Greeks were all into Gnosticism, the separation of the church and the flesh, and circumcision was of the flesh, and therefore the Greeks thought it was barbarian. So you've got the Greek influence and the Roman influence. They hate all things Jews and Jewish, so you can't base a new religion on a Jewish God. You can't do it. And so not in a Roman or Greek culture. So what they had to do is to create an entirely new God, and the new name and their new God had to be the totality of God, where the old guy is just completely forgotten about. And that was the purpose of the Nicene Council.
Yeah, it was to separate Yahusha from Yahweh. That's why they even came up with the new name there. Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
And
so,
Constantine represented British interests, by the way. That's why he chose Hesus from, you know, Stonehenge.
He did. His first battles were with his father, and his first battles were up there in Britain with his father. Now, so that's the third most influential Roman. The second most influential Roman is a guy that I won't even ask you to guess, because no one's ever heard of him. And he is easily the second most influential Roman. His name is Theodosius. Theodosius is his name. And Theodosius lived and ruled Rome out of the Eastern Roman Empire, 75 years after Constantine, so right around 400 CE.
Okay.
And the reason Theodosius is the second most influential Roman is that he's the guy that actually imposed and actually called it Nicene Christianity on the empire. At the time of Theodosius, if you did not acknowledge Nicene, which is this, you know, totally separate from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, no Hebrew legacy, no Torah connection, no connection to Yahweh. If you did not accept Nicene Christianity, you were killed. And so it was Theodosius.
That's pretty influential.
Yeah, he made Christianity the official, and not only the official, the only accepted religion within the Roman Empire. He also created the lord serf mentality that controlled feudal Europe for the next 1,000 years. He invented the fascist lord serf economic scheme and posed it.
Wow. Okay.
So he is the second most influential Roman. I'm going to give you another chance. Who is the single most influential Roman? And it's not even close. I mean, in fact, if I tell you the name, you're going to kick yourself. I mean, it's a million times more influential than Constantine or Theodosius. A million times.
You know, Cherie just said Paul.
Paul. Paul the Roman Paul. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, what I did here yesterday.
That makes sense, by the way. You know, and he claimed to be a Roman citizen.
Oh, boy. What I decided to do, it's right around the 21st to the 24th chapters of Acts. It's all about Paul's, you know, he has many different conversion experiences, and they're all different. And his aftermath.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
All three in Acts, and they're all three different.
Quran.
Yeah, and the aftermath of all three is just laughably different. But in the second of the three, Paul creates this whole scenario, and it's an elaborate tale, and every aspect of the elaborate tale is designed to cast Paul into the role of Savior. So if Yahusha was judged by the Sanhedrin, then Paul had to be judged by the Sanhedrin. If the Sanhedrin tore their cloaks, then they had to tear their cloaks for Paul. If Yahusha was whipped, Paul had to be whipped. If Yahusha had a Roman official say he was innocent, Paul had a Roman official say he was innocent. Every aspect of the story is designed to recast Paul as Savior. And then what's interesting, while Yahusha affirmed the Torah, Paul relied entirely, every time he had a chance, every time he was in trouble, he relied on the fact that he announced, I'm a Roman citizen, and according to Roman law, you can't do this. So throughout his entire experience, and this is now four chapters long, all he does is constantly say, I'm relying on Roman law as a Roman citizen. You can't do this to me. He had the Roman army and Roman law bail him out every time. That was always his savior. So I'm putting the chapter I'm writing right now. I'm detailing all of this. And then I said, okay, so what is Paul's most famous book?
Ephesians or Acts. I'm not sure.
Romans. And so after Paul has had this whole episode, and he's made up all of this stuff, and it's just such a transparent lie. And after all of that, he has his Lord, and he keeps on calling him Lord. He has his Lord meet with him, and the first thing his Lord tells him, after the Roman army has saved him time and time again, is, I want you to go to Rome. You're going to be my guy in Rome. And what is, in the book of Romans, in the 13th chapter of Romans, Paul writes that everyone has to subject themselves to Roman authority and to government authority.
Yeah, he does.
And if you don't subject yourself to government authority, according to Paul's letters, then you are bringing condemnation on yourself. And he says that every government was empowered expressly by God. They serve as agents of God. They are God's authority on earth, and you must submit to them. Now,
that's in direct opposition to what Hosea says, who says that you put this prince in charge and you put that king in charge, and I didn't know him. But yeah,
that's correct.
Yeah.
And sure. More importantly, or as importantly, I'm writing this because I'm translating Daniel 7, 8, and 9. And in Daniel 7 and 8, God says the most despicable empire to have ever existed. And he says, and it's still existing. And it has
the Romans.
It's been this merciless scab on the whole world.
Yeah, and so Rome. They'll be the hardest to get rid of, too. Yeah.
Rome. And so God is sitting there saying that Rome is the worst thing that you could ever, he says, of all of the empires, it's worse than Babylon, is Rome. And Rome is still alive. And the only way that Rome still lives today is because of Paul.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
that's
you compare what how merciless, how disgusting, how perverted, how murderous Rome was, and Paul is saying, oh, man, you've got to surrender.
Well, you know, you even see it, you know, there's so many different ways from a psychological standpoint that it's pushed, whether it's eagles on top of flags and, you know, and that symbol, which is entirely Roman. And in even Hollywood movies, like you take Gladiator, and here it just showed how ruthlessly where they made him a slave. You know, they were going to kill him, and he ends up becoming a gladiator, and in the end they bury him. He was a soldier of Rome, you know, and, he, you know, it looks so incredibly great to be a soldier of Rome, doesn't it?
What, I mean, really. What's really troubling about Rome is that the patriotism of Rome and the integration between religion and the military in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And how in Rome, the emperor was always commander-in-chief of the legions.
Kind of like a president today sort of
it's
thing.
It's identical to America. Mm-hmm. You know, with God bless our troops and how patriotism and militarism and military support and all of this are intertwined today. It is the Roman experience is identical to the American experience, and they
view
themselves as exceptional.
We're the closest thing.
I would even argue that America may be closer to Rome today than is the Vatican.
Well, I mean, I personally think that the Vatican has a great deal to do with running America. So yeah, I believe that. You know. I think it's one and the same. That's my opinion.
Wow. Yeah, it's really it is just unbelievably despicable. All right. We were at the 86th statement of the 119th Psalm. And Dode is saying every one of the terms and conditions of your relationship agreement is trustworthy and reliable. That wouldn't be 3 out of 4. It wouldn't be, you know, I found some good stuff in there. That wouldn't be, you know, maybe there's a few good nuggets out of the Torah, but we should discount the rest of it. Every one of the terms of and conditions of your relationship agreement is trustworthy and reliable. How many of them are there? Same number as you have fingers on your hand.
Terms and conditions, 5. Yeah, there's 5 benefits.
Yeah, 5.
Well. Mm-hmm.
So he says all 5 of them are reliable. They are walk away from your country. Boy, that sure happens to be the antithesis of what Paul said. He said, obey your country.
Oh, yeah, he did.
Submit to him. And here is, Yana was saying, terms, prerequisite 1, you want to engage in a relationship with me? You need to walk away from your country. Why? Because he doesn't want that patriotic political mindset that claims that your country is responsible for defending you. Like today, I was critical of the military in Afghanistan and Iraq, and IQ said, you know, that's not fair. The military is just following orders. The problem is your politicians. I said, well, that's only true up to a point. You know, if we didn't have this massive military, the politicians wouldn't get to deploy them in countries to make a bad situation worse. And he says, well, then if you didn't have the military, who would defend the country? I said, the citizens. That's how the Constitution
been defending
was
the country.
Yeah,
first of all, if we were going to defend the country, you and I both know that there would be actual guards. Maybe they'd put the military on the southern border if they were afraid of the invasion.
Right.
But they don't.
I mean,
that's pretty well intentional, too.
Yeah, they certainly don't. And
I don't remember being invaded. You know, I'm 55 years old. I don't recall.
Yeah, we've never even had anybody attempt to invade America. I mean, it's absurd. There's no one. America has been invaders, But we've never been invaded, and if we had no military, no one would even attempt to invade us. No one has the desire. No one has the ability. What God's point is, don't rely on your military. Don't rely on your country.
Right, and Paul's saying the opposite, but to understand what we understand, okay, those of us listening to this show and in the chat room, it's a little disheartening to sit on FB and every other post that goes by is thanking the military for defending our safety and our rights and all this other stuff.
And when you think about that for a moment, and that's why, and I know I'm tough to listen to on the Shattering Myth show, because it's one thing to say, here's what God has to say, and oh, by the way, it's totally contrary to your religion. Your religion is false. I mean, that's tough. But I'm also saying your patriotism should be discarded, and your military is not worth your respect. And they aren't defending your freedom, and you can't name a situation where the military defended American freedom. There is no situation. The closest you can get to it.
You got to go
the
back
war
to
of 18,
the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, the War of 18. Actually, the war. No, because in the Revolutionary War, 2/3 of Americans were opposed to the Revolution.
Right.
The only time you can get to it, and it's
war
only in one battle, and it's the War of 1812, where
yeah,
the U.S. had a military engage the British outside of Washington. They fought for about 15 minutes. They retreated, and the British came in and wiped out Washington.
Yeah, and
that's
burned
it.
The White House to the ground.
Yeah.
Or
right. All yeah. the rest of the battles in the War of 1812 were fought by militias, private citizens.
Yeah, it was always militias doing the work. That's who did all the winning in the Revolutionary War, as a matter
of course.
Of fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is you can't name a situation where the U.S. military defended American freedom, that they kept America free. It does not exist. We fought a lot of battles, 101 of them. But there's not a single battle that America fought where the U.S. military was deployed to keep America free. And so when you realize how high a percentage of the population is not only indoctrinated that we owe our military our freedom and say it routinely, then you realize how easy people are to fool and how many people can't be in the covenant. Because in the covenant, if you're viewing your military as your source of freedom, you're not part of the covenant. God not only says, I want you to walk away from your country, disassociate from it, but his next line is, I want you to trust and rely on me. You're not trusting and relying on him for your security if you're instead thanking your police and your firemen and your military.
Most people I know are a little afraid of what they're doing, you know. Doing
absolutely.
This.
They should
they should be. And I think most people are, and I think people are beginning to realize we live in a police state.
We do.
And when you start having, drills where the military's running around taking guns, they did that down in New Orleans, by the way, after the flood. Then they left people unarmed in a terrible situation.
Yeah, and they're going to get... Because of political correctness in schools, it's only a matter of time before they get an overwhelming preponderance of Americans siding with them in removing guns from citizens.
I'm sure they...
Just a
matter
of time.
I think they got more pushback than they expected. Over the next 10 years, they may not have enough time.
We'll see. By the way, before we move to the next term and condition of the covenant, I don't want to forget this. I think I may have made a significant mistake. I was trying to figure out how in the world the Teruah harvest, when I'm doing all this stuff where I'm back, in Pauline mode, because I've got to show how Paul is the embodiment of Rome. So excuse me for slipping you. Because that's where I'm spending my research time right now. But I have said that based upon the line in Revelation speaking to the Philadelphian Ecclesia that says that that those who love his name and love his word are kept out of the tribulation. That means that you have to be harvested prior to the beginning of the tribulation, which means the last possible teruah would be teruah in 2026. Mm-hmm. Of course, we really don't, you know, Yosha didn't speak Greek. We don't have great manuscripts of Revelation, and you really got to discount that stuff. So
right.
now I'm if you look at Yeshaya 17, which mm-hmm. provides us with the timing of the teruah harvest, and it's after Israel is dissected.
Mm-hmm.
It comes after Israel is dissected. Now, you turn to Daniel 9, and you find that the Torahless one commences the tribulation and becomes known when he affirms a treaty with the world involving Israel, and immediately thereafter you have the Magog War. Okay? So for the only way for the teruah harvest to take place after Yisrael is dissected at the waist, mm-hmm. is that it happens sometime shortly after the beginning of the tribulation. Now, keep in mind that when you read Daniel 7 and 8, what becomes absolutely evident is that there's while there is 7 years, it's 3.5 years of it that's the real tribulation, that's the intense part. There's 3.5 years where Yahweh says, I'm out of here. I'm going to turn over this planet to Satan. I'm out of here. And all hell breaks loose. And so it's a miserable time on this planet. There is a distinct possibility that Yahweh won't remove us, his covenant children, from this planet.
Until the middle.
Until the middle, just before the middle of the tribulation begins. Because that way we have the opportunity, whereas the whole world is falling apart and these choices are so important for people to make, we have the chance to still be witnesses. And he's still keeping us out of the major torment of the tribulation. It seems to be more consistent with what I read in Daniel and what I've just done in Yeshaya is mm-hmm. That it's not going to occur in the fall of 2026, but could, I don't want to say it's not. Well, it's still possible for the fall of 2026. I just want to say
you're
that
saying it could go to 2029.
That I am saying that it could go to 2027, 2028, 2029, and even possibly 2030.
Wow.
Okay. So, because Yahweh is really clear in his testimony in Hebrew that the teruah harvest occurs after the treaty that thins Israel.
That's right.
And that occurs prior to what his definition of the hellish period of the tribulation in Daniel is 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a possibility somewhere in that period.
Yeah, I guess there would be. And you know, if you think about it, the guy that embodies Torahlessness that's going to rule the world, yeah, he's going to have to set that treaty up prior to. We'll know who he is. I think the whole world will be fawning over him, and the rest of us will be going, we know who that is.
Yeah. By the way, there's some other things that I just want to share on Daniel that it will help those who, like me, were fascinated by Christian prophecy. There is no chance in the world that the Torahless one is building a new temple on the Temple Mount. Ain't happening. This idea that the world somehow comes back to celebrating Pesach, Matzah, Bukkotim, and the sacrifices in the temple prior to Yahweh returning, it never made any sense to me. It isn't going to happen. That's not what he's saying. The problem with the English Bibles is that they're translating Kodesh inconsistently. And they want to translate Kodesh sanctuary. So when they have this, a change in the celebrations and the observations associated with their Antichrist, they want it focused on a temple and their sacrifices that are going to have their dates changed. That's not what's happening at all, at least based upon the translations that I've done. I think all that the Torahless One is going to do is he's going to do what Hadrian did. He's going to make Yahweh's feasts, his mikre, illegal.
Okay, yeah, and now that, I can believe that. I can believe that. Yeah.
He's going to make them illegal, and then he is going to legislate his substitutes. But I'm convinced that if you know Paul, then you know the Torahless One thought to be the Antichrist by Christians. They will be indistinguishable. And so you're likely to have the imposition of the Christian holidays. And that those holidays
and Sunday mandatory day off.
Mandatory. Yeah, Christmas mandatory, Easter mandatory, and it'll be illegal to use Yahweh's name. It'll be illegal to celebrate the Shabbat. It'll be illegal to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shavua. Illegal, penalty of death. It'll be illegal to be circumcised. Illegal.
Now, how are they translating set apart? What are they, or Kodesh?
The first two times it appears they translated saint. And thereafter
saint.
they translated sanctuary.
Sanctuary and saint, neither of which have anything to do with Kodesh.
Correct.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of misinformation that is coming about feeding Christian eschatology as a result of what it says. And what I think happened here is that the Latin Vulgate translations of Revelation became so ingrained that Daniel then had to be rendered such that it was consistent with Revelation, because most of Revelation, the heart of Revelation,
so they went
from
down
like
and retranslated
12,
Daniel.
Yeah, from 10 to 12 all the way through about 19 is Yosha's explanation of Daniel 7, 8, and 9. And so it's just like Gabriel came down and he explained, because Daniel's saying, you know, I don't really get this. You're blowing my mind here. I don't understand it. I need some help. And then Gabriel says, okay, let me explain what all these things are to you. Revelation from like 10 to 12 through 19 is Yosha saying, you know, some other others of you might need a little help here too. So let me explain Daniel 7, 8, and 9 to you. And that's basically what it is. And so they wanted Daniel 7, 8, and 9 to harmonize with Revelation. And so I think that's why we have so many errant pronunciations. Anyway, give me a few weeks. I'm still working on this. I'll have four chapters.
No, it's very interesting stuff. I mean, see, that again goes right back to what you were saying earlier. You're rooting out corruption. You root out the corruption. You find
correct.
The corruption.
Go where the words
you
lead.
You understand why they did it.
Yeah, just go
right.
Where the words lead. Go where the words lead. If you go where the words lead, you can't be in any trouble. If there's two things that I want to communicate here is that there is the real possibility, and it just hit me this morning like a lightning bolt, and I don't want to use that term because that's associated with Hasatan, but it was a tingly, oh my goodness, I could have this wrong. I had better, and I'm not saying I do have it wrong, but I really could have it wrong. I hope I have it wrong. I think I have it wrong. I want to have it wrong. that we may be here three, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 years longer than I previously thought.
Well, if you put the succession, okay, in the way that it's done in Yashayahu 17,
yes,
then the Torahless one, this dictator, right, monster, he,
yes,
has to appear. And we will know who he is. I mean, we're going to know who he is.
Oh,
I'm not saying
he's going to be a Christian. He's going to sound exactly like Paul. Now,
yeah,
he is. He's not going to represent your least favorite organization. He's not going to be a Roman Catholic. He's going to be from the Eastern Orthodox Church.
And that's fine. I mean, this, to me, it's one and the same. I mean,
they are one and the same.
Born
and
of the same beast.
Same.
It doesn't matter. When I say RC, I mean, that's kind of a catch-all, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that includes them. It includes the Orthodox. It includes,
right,
the Jesuits. They're all the same outfit,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah. But the,
I mean, really,
the Eastern Orthodox Church is the difference between it and the Roman Catholic. Collectively, it's very close to the same size. It's just that the Eastern Orthodox Church has, you know, the Russian Orthodox is Eastern Orthodox. The Copt Christians in Egypt are Eastern Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
The Russian Orthodox Church, the Assyrians, all these are the Macedonians. The Greeks, you know, the Greeks are overwhelmingly Christian. It's Eastern Orthodox Church.
Yeah, they're Orthodox. Sure they are.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, well,
Just
to throw this out there, you know, I mean, as I look at them, they're all pretty much the same. But, you know, one of the things that I've seen in Revelation is they talk about, and they turn on her, and they burn all our buildings that are all over the, you know, the face of the earth. I think that the Eastern Orthodox Church, I think it makes sense to me, is going to turn on the Catholics once they've assumed power and burn them down.
They're certainly capable of, right now, like the Ukrainian, which is the Eastern Orthodox Church, and the Russian Orthodox Church are at war with each other. So it's certainly possible. They have been in the past. I was reading the other day because it came up that the United States is now admitting that we made a horrific mistake and urging the United Nations to leave Rwanda. Within 100 days of the time that America urged the UN to leave Rwanda, 800,000 people were dead.
You're talking about when Rwanda, Burundi, when the Hutus and the Tutsis,
yeah, exactly,
got into it.
Yeah,
okay.
And so the reason this might sound is pretty far afield, it isn't. So I was looking at religion, Rwanda. I wanted to find out what was the cause, because religion is almost always the cause. And you find that between 60 and 70% of Rwandans are Roman Catholic. And then what I found is that it was the way that the Roman Catholics treated the two tribes and the animosity that the Roman Catholic Church created between the two tribes that was the ultimate wedge that led to...
Yeah, one had if you had a wider nose, you were either called Hutu or Tutsi, vice versa, whatever. And they treated one group differently than the other for that reason or something.
The Roman Catholic Church did. Yeah.
Yeah.
The inspiration for that genocide falls right at the feet of the Roman Catholic Church. All right, so there are five terms and conditions of the covenant. All five, by the way, are related, but the first two are absolutely related. You can't have one without the other. If you're not willing to disassociate yourself from politics and religion and militarism and that kind of thing, then you can't trust and rely on Yahweh. And if you trust and rely on Yahweh, you have no need for that stuff. So they are related. The third, of course, is to walk to God and become perfect. That's the Mikra, walking to Him and celebrating these seven annual called-out assembly meetings. And then the next is pay attention to what we're talking about right now. Pay attention to the terms and conditions of the covenant. Everything depends on it. As a matter of fact, Don today in Shattering Mist, he called in because he is an expert on the Seventh-day Adventists, and that's where we began. that's not where we ended up. We then traveled through the Dead Sea Scrolls. And ultimately, Don made two statements that are the single most important things that I have come personally to realize in the last 10 years. I'm going to share one of them with you and then the reason why I brought this up. The first that he shared is when he came to understand the eternal nature of Hebrew and that all nouns in Hebrews are defined by the actionable nature of the verbs, so that it's an action-oriented language where every word takes meaning based upon the action form, the verbal form of the language, which means this is an engaged voyage of discovery, and that every noun is defined by the verbs, and that every verb is unlimited in time, as is Yahweh. They're not stuck in time. There's no past, present, and future. And then he says, then you add that to the fact that every verb has a stem, which shows the relationship between us and God. And then most verbs have a mood that tells us that this is volitional, and that it describes what things are God's will versus what God wants us to choose. And when you come to realize that Hebrew is such that when you're reading the Hebrew text of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, you're right there with God. Those words are Yahweh. He is right there in your presence. You're having a direct conversation with him. Those words are him. Literally, are him. And, you know, that for me was just blew my mind when I first encountered that. And the second thing was something you and I talked about last week, Larry, which Don said, you know, as a Seventh-day Adventist, you were constantly trying to prove or affirm that you were saved. And he says, when it finally dawned on me, and when he finally, Don, let go of Paul, when he realized that God's not talking salvation at all. It's a byproduct. That all we really ought to be focusing on, are we adopted? Are we part of the covenant? And if you're part of the covenant, you don't have to worry about salvation. Never even have to
salvation
think about
it. Is such a limited form of what, I mean, that's just almost a nothing, actually.
It's a nothing in comparison to all of the somethings that are associated with the participation in the covenant.
When people sit around and pray in a church for salvation, they're just praying for life. I mean, they're not with any understanding that you're going to be a being of light, of pure energy, you know, and amplified and so forth. Yeah.
So that was the it's why I'm sharing that the fourth condition of participating in the covenant is to know the terms and conditions of the covenant, which is to know that really all the Yahweh is interested in is us coming to know him and wanting to be part of his family. And once we make that decision that we're going to prioritize coming to know him and being part of his family, the rest of it is just pure joy. The rest of it is all gain. The rest of it is you're totally liberated, totally free, and totally empowered, totally enriched. It's you never, ever again have to say, gee, I wonder if I'm saved. I mean,
this is why your position, you've been saying, you know, for a long, long time that, you know, the Torah is the most freeing document ever written in history.
Correct.
And that's right. I mean, that's your freedom. I mean, if you want to rely on Yada, to save himself, well, you wouldn't know how.
I remembered being a Christian and always wanting to know that I'm saved and always trying to convince somebody else that I was saved. And now that I've come to understand the Torah and its covenant, I don't even think about it.
Well, they're pretty empty words. When somebody comes somebody comes to me and says, are you saved? I just look at that as religious jargon.
Yeah.
Much like
and, of course,
holy
the last part of the terms and conditions of the covenant, if as parents we're asked to circumcise our children because that's our job, is to raise them to become Yahweh's children.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the five terms and conditions there, no doubt about it. Yeah.
So, he's saying everyone of the terms and conditions of your covenant relationship are trustworthy and reliable. The liars who deceive and mislead, pursue and persecute me. So please support and assist me.
Uh-huh. And that's what we were talking about.
Yep.
Assisting. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
And I
yeah,
like
exactly.
doing that, by the way.
You know,
yeah.
Yahweh made all of this challenging. He didn't make it hard. He made it challenging. You have no chance of getting to know who he is, coming to understand the terms and conditions of the covenant, and acting upon them unless you are really serious, unless your whole mindset is, I want to know who God is. I want to have a relationship with him. Because there is no magic credo. There is no four spiritual laws. There's no profession of faith. There's no cliff notes here. There's no shortchanging the voyage of discovery. You've really got to come to the place where you said, okay, I understand what these mikrae are. I understand what the terms and conditions are. I understand the benefits of the covenant. I understand that Yahweh is as Father. Once you've devoted the time, then all of this is just resonates within you. Then you're somebody that God wants to have a relationship. You're somebody he wants to spend eternity with because you value knowing. You value understanding. This is a priority for you. Can you imagine all of the nut jobs we'd have in eternity if a simple profession of faith were sufficient to get in?
Yeah. Well, that's putting it kindly. Yeah, you'd look like the Chicago Cubs out there. You know, look like you got beat before you ever got started. You know, look like any church group out there. Just outrageous.
I'm looking forward to having disagreements in eternity and having debates in eternity and interesting discussions from different perspectives in eternity. But I don't really want to spend eternity with nincompoops. You know, and
no.
You could be
no,
an
no.
absolute idiot susceptible to being misled if God made it easy.
Can you imagine Yahweh wanting, say, a guy who spent 40 years of his life discovering what the people in Qumran were like? You know, a theologian. Could you imagine Yahweh even allowing that anywhere near him? Because he was focused completely on everything that that was wrong.
You know, for example, in Qumran, 30% of the scrolls in Qumran are secular. They're the business transactions and the day-to-day correspondence
and everything.
Of the locals. They're actually mostly in Hebrew. Big myth that every time I turn around I'm finding that was just a huge lie that was by anti-Hebrew people that Yosha spoke Aramaic. He spoke Hebrew.
I never said he spoke Aramaic.
No. I wasn't accusing you. The prevalent view in the world is that Yosha spoke Aramaic. He didn't. He spoke Hebrew. Hebrew. And the people that he was speaking to, they spoke and understood Hebrew. Which makes perfect sense, by the way. It's just another thing you can discard. Forget about the Aramaic thing. It's Hebrew. But one of the few times here I've just lost my train of thought on all of this. Maybe I'll catch it. But as we look at just this particular statement here, Dode is announcing something that is important, that he had enemies because he chose the narrow, highly restrictive path to Yahweh. And therefore, what he had to say was in opposition of those who had a political, a military, or a religious agenda. And so he was saying that he was being, that those who lie and deceive were trying to pursue and persecute him. That's what happens to us. You want to tell the truth? You want to be on the side of Yahweh? You are going to make a lot of enemies. And then his his comment to Yahweh is, all right, I'm going to take the time to prepare. And he did. But, you know, I'm going to need some help here. I don't want to do this alone. And I think that's what God is looking for. He wants us to do what Doe did, to study, to come to understand, to prepare, and then say, okay, you know, I grasp the material. Let's go out and do this, and let's do it together.
Yeah, let's stand up together. I find that Yah delivers my enemies into my hands all the time.
Yes.
It's a very strange thing. I'll be on a note, and then I'll just pop to another note, and the next thing out of their mouth, I've got the debate material right in front of me in this other note. I know that sounds weird, but I mean it. And at the same time, I find every time I go into the Torah and give it a good look, I learn something else. You know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
You know, and your perspectives have helped a lot. Yeah, I mean, you know, I sit there and I look at, you know, as an example, Abraham coming up to Mount Moriah, and, you know, he sees it at a distance 3 miles away. Now, you know, that means something. And then, you know, it's the three mikra that
right.
being
and
about.
And the perspective that provides for us. Yeah, you know, one of the things, Larry, is that there was a period of time where I thought that I was coming to understand and conveying a unique Torah-centric perspective that would be helpful not only for me but for others, and that's why I started writing.
Mm-hmm.
I have subsequently come to the position that that's not the case, that the perspective that I've been trying to, the one that I came to and that I've been trying to share happens to be identical to what the one we're reading right here. I'm not,
right.
It happens to be Dode's perspective. And as I read Dabadim and Moshe trying to say, all right, Yahweh has spoken to us about all these things. Let's understand what he said and let's apply it to our lives. And Dabarim, Moshe's perception of the Torah and Dabarim in words is identical to what we're sharing here. And I've kind of just got to the position of saying that no, it's not unique. All
well,
I've done
it's
is
not
just,
unique,
just stumble
but
back
it's
in
rare.
Time to what
it's not unique, but it's rare.
Yeah, to what Dode was saying.
Yeah, but still, that's rare. That's a rare perspective. You know that everyone wants to take a religious perspective because the religious clerics basically usurp the scripts. They copy-edited them. They rewrote them. They added traditions. And that's all people have known for thousands of years.
Yeah.
They never really thought about sitting down, for the most part, and reading the words.
Yeah.
You know, we're all conditioned to believe that a theologian knows more than we do. Now, I don't believe that at all anymore. I laugh at I think they're all boobs.
No, they
That's
are.
My opinion of them.
Yeah, they are. They,
you know?
They may know many things. They don't understand anything.
They don't understand.
You know, I was going to say that we were talking about the Qumran scrolls. That 30% are secular. So the guy, the scholar that wants to know about the Qumran society, do I care? Do you care? Can we learn anything about the economics of the Qumran society?
I've even told you, I don't care if they're cannibals, but yeah.
I don't care either. And then a third of the manuscripts are peculiar to the Essenes. You know, there were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. They all had their own peculiarities. And a third of the texts are, you know, their righteous teacher, their temple scroll, and, you know, they've got the Book of Enoch, and they've got Jubilees, and they've got that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and
right.
So they're peculiar to them. I will tell you that I read a little bit about the righteous teacher because I wanted to understand.
He was just a religious leader, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah,
he
was a religious leader. Oh, yeah, he was. The issue was that during the time of the Maccabees, there were two different groups. There was a heavily Greek-influenced clerical group among Judaism, and there was a traditional, let's say, to the Hebrew side of things. they were both in opposition to the Torah. They were both into the Talmud and oral law, but they disagreed, and they had a split, and the righteous teacher was on the side that lost. And so the Essenes, loved the righteous teacher, and so that's kind of the whole story. And you find out what it is that he said, and why they turned him into essentially a god. But beyond just kind of getting a feel for what the texts were, you could bring in the foremost expert on that 60% of the Qumran texts. Mm-hmm. And I think I could stand them for about a minute, and I'd say, okay, enough already. I don't care. The only thing I care about the Qumran text is not the Qumran community. It's I've got an older manuscript. I've got a manuscript that wasn't
shuffled
to
Babylon.
That's
the whole worth of it, right there, period. End of story. Yeah, that's
I've got a manuscript that wasn't dragged through Babylon. I like that. Really is the... And the oldest Masoretic text that was dragged through Babylon is from the 11th century. And we've got Qumran texts that are from the 3rd century BCE. I mean, there's 1,300 years of copy edits in between those two. But that's their only value. All right, so it goes on to say, in accordance with their diminutive worth, this feeds right into your thought process, Larry, that all those
That's
people
right.
that are they, would you call them boobs? And in accord with their diminutive worth, they yearn to completely destroy me, eliminating me from the earth. But I have not abandoned your precepts, those instructions which you have entrusted to us, encouraging us to pay close attention to so that we can respond appropriately to you. Pakudim is part of the big four of the 119th Psalm. Pakudim is God's instructions. He is his prescriptions that he has entrusted to us that enable us to respond appropriately to him. So the Pakudim and the Choke, one is, if I were to try to differentiate these two, because, there's the four things. There's the Choke, the Pakudim, the Mitzvot, and the Mitzvah. And two of the four are really obvious. The mitzvah or the
choke
conditions
is engraved. I mean, it's
right.
Flat, it's
so you go to the action engraved. Point of the verb, and choke means to cut in. So he engraved testimony such that it was cut into stone that cuts us into the covenant relationship. That's choke. Okay, so anything that illuminates how we become part of the covenant family that is unchanging, unwavering, that's choke. The Pakudim, the action part of Pakudim actually is a prescription that enables a person to respond. So it's a take in information that encourages a response. So it's the free will aspect of all of this. So you've got the choke, which are the, I've given you my information, I've chiseled in stone for you to cut you into the relationship. The Pakudim is the response part of it. That the aspects of God's teaching regarding his covenant that encourage us to respond to him.
Yeah, like having our children circumcised,
right,
and showing up for the seven set apart assemblies,
right,
and so forth. Yeah.
A response to God would be listening to him.
Well,
rather than babbling on in prayer and telling God, "Oh, I want this, right. I want that, I want this, I want that," listen to him. Just listen.
That's engaging. Yeah, was listening to his words and thinking about what he said. And
yes,
yeah, that's where we're supposed to be.
I don't care how smart you think you are, and I don't think I'm very smart, but I can tell you that when you listen to God, what he has to say is a lot more interesting than what we have to say. So,
yeah, I don't
to
think
it.
There's very many interesting conversations outside his words. Look,
no,
you can
I would agree.
Anybody that's sitting in this chat room, and every one of them have been in social situations where they brought up Yahweh's words and they found themselves in the corner talking to themselves. That's what I know.
You know what's also interesting? Somebody wrote this, and I just saw it pass by, and I may be misquoting them, and I'm sorry if I am, but that the overwhelming preponderance of those who are listening tonight have been together as part of the covenant family for more than 5 years, and that we all know each other. We know each other's code names. We know each other lives. We know about each other's families. We correspond with one another. We do the stuff of family. We have been together and grown together for a long time. And there are enormous contributors to this family. I was thinking as I was writing down, for example, the three websites that were presented in Shattering Myths today. All of those individuals, the blessyahweh.com site, the yhwh-kara, .com site, the sites that I have, the Power on High website, all of us pay to give away information. None of us charge anything, and all of us actually pay out of our own pocket to make this information available to people.
Yeah,
it's the antithesis of religion.
Right. I've heard a lot of people, you know, one of the things that Richard does on his Bless Yahweh site is he said, if you'll notice, there's not a donate button on here.
Right.
People comment to me all the time.
Yeah.
They love it. You know,
think of Richard for a moment. Now, we all know Richard and Christy, wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
We all have one thing in common. We all love Yahweh. Another thing in common, we all want to know more about him. And we all want to share what we know about him. But no one's going to mistake Richard for Donald Trump. And and Christie's had some health related issues, and I mean there's been some challenges between Richard and Christie, and yet here's a guy that is not just paying to host the truth, but he's donating his time making a
That's
huge
right.
contribution of his time and his money to share what he knows and loves about Yahweh. It is something that is common to all of us. You know, it's we freely give.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I know people that actually probably bend over way too backwards for people that maybe they shouldn't in order to give, you know, to hand out the truth.
Yes.
And,
we are
you know.
Not, by the way, a cheerful giver in the sense of, Richard, for example, has a contact us button on there. And he's shared with me some of the letters that he has exchanged with people. And, you know, if... he suffers fools about as well as you do, which may even be worse than I do. And, you know, we all have this in common. We, we're willing to give the information free. If you want to criticize Yahweh, we're just not going to be warm and fuzzy. And we're just not. It's
you know, well,
the bottom line.
I don't see anywhere where we're supposed to be.
No, we're not.
No, there's a division.
The point still is interesting to make is that we all have a very similar reaction to those who wish to promote religion and be critical of Yah's testimony. And it's not fuzzy-wuzzy.
No, it's not. I mean, I don't see the point. When somebody is in direct opposition and they're throwing up religion like a bomb,
yeah,
you know, in order to and you know to mask and to fog and to cloud the issue, which is
yeah.
these are all you know satanic in their very.
Let me throw out something here that might make you feel. I don't think it'll make you feel uncomfortable, and I don't know if Don is listening. Don was really effective today, and you're really effective on Chattering Myths because it is it's obvious to anyone listening to Don or to you. You're man's man. No nonsense. We're not going to pussyfoot around. I am not going to pretend that I like you if I don't like you.
No, that's
you know,
true.
I am not going to tolerate. I'm not going to play nice just to get along. And Don's exactly the same way. And when you and I think that's exactly the voice, the tone, and the attitude that Yosha manifests. And as I read Yanowa's words, I see exactly that tone. As I'm reading here, this song that's Dode wrote, man's man, knows who he is, suffers fools very poorly, happy to share everything he has. He would give you everything he has if it's going to help you come to know Yahweh. But if you're going to oppose him, to hell with you.
Right.
And
yeah,
and
I mean,
vicious,
the world
right back in your snoz.
You know, the world kind of defines itself as, you know, you see this all the time. You know, they give to starving Biafran children, or they give to this, or they give to that. There's nothing wrong with giving to people. But if you think that that adds up to 2 points in Yahweh's world, you're wrong. You know, you're just wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not how it works out. You know, feeding the family with words. And I think that Lisa just said in the chat room, you know, we feed the hungry. Well, how do we do that? Well, we do it with Yahweh's words. I mean,
exactly.
That's what counts.
Yeah.
I mean,
What are you, and somebody says, well, you know, what is your charity? What are you donating my
charity,
time
pagan
to share Yahweh's testimony? There is nothing I could offer anyone as valuable. Is it mine to give? No. But it certainly is mine to share, because once you're part of the covenant family, the Torah is yours. It's ours to share. You know, it's our family constitution. We inherit.
That's right.
We inherit it.
Right.
It's ours to share, and we ought to be doing that. So, according to your unfailing kindness and enduring love, Chesed, be merciful to me, so that I might focus upon your precepts and respond appropriately to you. Dode listened to everything God had to say. He came to the conclusion that he's merciful, that he's loving, that he's kind, and that his prescriptions are all designed to enable us to respond appropriately to him. You know, so many people think that the God of the Old Testament is mean, that he's wrathful. Well, he is at times when it's appropriate to be, but with his children, there is nothing any one of us could do to anger him. We just can't.
There's not one person that represents Yahweh as a monster. That Old Testament God, you know, as they say, that takes into account the groups that were being killed were religious monsters.
Yeah,
they don't
know. They were monsters.
They don't understand it. They don't consider it. They've never thought about it, and they don't care. And that's what I know, you know. So
yeah. Now we're beginning a stanza that is brought to us by the shepherd's staff. It's the Hebrew Lamed. The Lamed is a shepherd's staff. And it conveys all the things of a shepherd's staff. Guidance, leadership, nurturing, genuine care and concern, observation, watching over, caring about, protecting, leading, feeding those under your care. And the first word, as we deal with the shepherd staff is Yahweh. Yahweh, your word stands forever in the spiritual realm of the heavens. Yahweh's word can't stand forever on earth. Why do you suspect that is? Why did he have to
quantify this? Because the earth won't be here forever.
That is correct. So Yahweh's word outlasts the earth. And by the way, Yahweh and Dabar are essentially synonymous. Yahweh's the name. Dabar is who he is. I occasionally am challenged to say, you know, you can't say that you know Yahweh because he's never been in your presence. and I would disagree entirely. When we are studying his testimony right here and reading his words, he's right here. He's as real as he is when, you know, when we're in heaven. He's no more or less real than he is in his words. His words represent him forever. And you're right. It has to be quantified in the spiritual realm, because the earth, even at, what is it now, 3.5 billion years old, its shelf life is a nanosecond compared to eternity. Throughout time and through the generations, you have been absolutely trustworthy and resolutely dependable. You fashioned and formed the earth, and it stands and is sustained. The one thing that there's a lot of things about Christianity, and we keep talking about it because those are the people we need to help the most. They're the most prevalent, although there's a lot of agnostics out there today. That
because of Christianity, too.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's true. Well, most agnostics are agnostics.
I mean, you just said it. The earth is three. The Arits are 3.5 billion years old out here.
And
so now you've got the agnostics or the atheists, and you got to remember their story.
Right.
Of macroevolution, right. Over billions and billions and billions of years. Right. Well, there's only about 3 billion of them.
Well, actually, if you want to deal with the conception of life,
the plant life,
section of life, you're only dealing with 5 billion years. It's from the time that the first plant life form appeared on the for animals, the time that the first animal life form appeared on the earth to you had all of the 34 phyla of animal life forms.
You're saying 5 million?
5 million years.
Yeah. Now that I believe.
5 million years is the entire spectrum. And it could be much less than that, but it can be no more than that. And that's the problem. That's why Scientific American actually retracted the statement that life from inorganic material scientists will acknowledge is impossible. But what they said is that even the impossible, given an infinite amount of time of billions of years, that the impossible can be possible. And that was the claim of evolution, is that if you have 3 billion years, then the impossible becomes possible. Mathematically, life from inorganic material is impossible. And so, but they said over 3 billion years, then it becomes possible. What the Cambrian explosion demonstrated, and what we now know for certain in the fossil record, is that this all took place in 5 million years. And all of a sudden, you don't have the time to make the impossible possible. And that's why Scientific American printed a retraction.
Hmm. I didn't know they did that, but
it's nice. They said it's the only retraction in the history of the magazine. It was a cover story, and they then printed a retraction and said, now that we know of the Cambrian explosion, and we've discovered the deposits, the supposition that evolution worked because we had so much time is just not true. And so you know what scientists are trying to do now? If you watch all these, they really, you know, the media savvy scientists, and they're all on Discovery Channel and all that kind of stuff, the Cosmos show on, I guess, is NBC, is now what they're saying is because they recognize that spontaneous generation of life, non-created life, is impossible on Earth, that it could not have happened, absolutely impossible. What they're now saying is that life forms came on into Earth on comets. And when the comets, they came, they're from other, now, by the way, they
wouldn't they, comets kind of burn
but it can't be this solar system.
Alive to death?
Yeah,
I mean,
can't be this
on.
Solar system because there is no life in this solar system other than on Earth. And the comets are part of this solar system. So they've got a little problem there. So their argument is that a comet from another solar system So, which that just that's no such thing. But and that the life was created there where they have the billions of years, and it rode into Earth on the on the comet, and it must have been 34 comets simultaneously, because we got all 34 life forms.
Can I ask you something here? I mean,
yeah.
Just from a scientific standpoint,
yes.
Is there anything you know that's alive on Earth that could withstand the heat of a comet?
Well, no, it's actually what they say is that comets are frozen water. Freezing something doesn't kill it. And now when it comes through the Earth's atmosphere, of course, it's going to get insanely hot. But what they're saying is, okay, if you've got a comet that was large enough, then maybe part of that comet would still be frozen when it hit the Earth. But the problem of that is when you get a large impact, a large comet, a large asteroid that hits the Earth, what happens?
Oh, you got a what's called a crater.
Oh, yeah, explosion. An explosion. And
yeah,
if you get one that's really large, it's a fireball over the entire Earth. I mean, the theory won't work, of course, if you think it through. But
you talk about grasping at straws over
oh,
here.
Oh, of course.
35 of them at once. Whoa.
I know. Anything but admit that Yahweh was right.
Maybe they were Anaki, you know.
Anything but admit that Yahweh is right. And, you know, I've just come to the conclusion that if I start with the supposition, Yahweh is always right, that I don't get into much trouble these days. So I just say, all right, if God said it's this way, it's this way. And now I will try to wrap my mind around it sometimes and say, okay, why did God say it's that way? But I will never... never debate as to whether or not it is that way.
Well, you're talking about some pretty insane theory over there. You know, I should write books for these guys. I can come up with some pretty creative and imaginative stuff.
I don't know.
Can
you do better than the all the souls in the volcano and the extraterrestrial and Scientology? That's pretty clever.
Probably not.
How about the angel that told, Joseph Smith that the Jews built a mighty ship and they sailed over to the Americas and that all the native Americans were actually Jews?
Yeah, well, if you look, give me 5 days to read, just cram with this stuff, I could go to bed and just have insane ideas. I could build on top of them, and it wouldn't be long. You know, I could appear to be a religious leader, I bet. You know, but, I mean, they have nothing on the people calling themselves scientists, do they?
I mean, anybody's going to have
36 comets coming in all at once.
I think
figured that out. You know.
I'm going to opt out of all of this because I'm going to stick with my original supposition. Yahweh is always right. One of the things I have found about Yahweh, if you get too big for your britches and you think you know better than he does and you promote a theory that's inconsistent with him, he doesn't like that so much. And as his children, I said a while ago, that as a member of the covenant family, there's nothing we can do that upsets God. You know, at this point, we're not going to make him mad. It's just because once you come to know him, you're just not going to do that kind of stuff. You can kid about it, but you're just not going to do it.
No, you're right. I mean, I'm not going to go out on that path. I was just saying. I mean, you can create some pretty bizarre stuff. Matter of fact, it took some pretty bizarre people who call themselves scientists to even come up with such an absurd, a thesis that, life came riding in from different solar systems on a comet.
Yeah, and comet.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and you shake your head and say, wow. And you think you're smart.
I'm just asking who's writing this stuff. I mean, it's pretty crazy. I mean, really.
Desperate to have an answer when all their answers are wrong. It's like them saying, well, we understand how the universe works when our equations are errant by 94%.
Yeah, by not understanding any more than 4% of the universe, and even then
right.
we don't understand 4% of the universe. We,
yeah.
There's all this dark matter, and everything's happening,
right.
and
yeah.
it's
and,
off.
And of course,
scale.
The matter is not dark, and the energy is not dark. It's just that the energy and the matter.
Yeah, nobody knows
allude,
where it's coming
allude
from.
Allude our perceptions
right.
and understanding.
No, I get. I'm not saying it as a pejorative.
Yeah.
Type.
Yeah,
art,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Well, I know you aren't, but still, it's important that the listener would know that even though scientists have chosen the term dark energy and dark matter,
yeah, it's
all
probably
that, all that is really being conveyed is that our we don't have an ability to perceive what it is. We can measure its influence, but we literally don't have a clue what it is. You know, one of the most pervasive influences, I won't call it a force, one of the most pervasive influence in our universe and in our personal world is gravity. And there isn't a single scientist anywhere in the world that can tell you what gravity is.
That's amazing.
You aware of that? Yeah. They can tell you, they can't tell you how gravity works. They can quantify the influence of gravity. They can say, you know, that gravity is a tendency of mass to attract.
Yeah, they can say bowling ball falling out of a 100-story building falls at
right.
blah blah blah.
Right.
Sure.
But so they can measure its influence, but there isn't a scientist in the world that can tell you whether or not gravity is a influence, an effect, or a force. We don't even know
magnet,
if it's an effect or
magnetic
a force.
Pole or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we don't know, and we have no idea what it is or how it works. That's
and
pretty
that's astounding. That's astounding.
Well, let me give you
because
something
you
else
know
even more astounding.
There's been hundreds of studies.
To you
what?
And me, if I were to ask you what part of you, Larry, is the single most important part of you?
The single most important part to me would be my nesama.
Yes,
your
soul. Your soul,
that would,
your nefesh, your soul. Yeah, the nesama is a nice gift that God has given us. But our soul is it's our soul that goes on in eternity. It gives us our unique personality and perspective. Do you know that there isn't a scientist anywhere in the world that could even begin to tell you what a soul is? They can't measure it. They can't quantify it. They don't know where it goes, how it comes to be.
Yeah, the only thing you have is the false story that a person loses 6 ounces immediately upon death.
Yeah, that's not true, by the way.
No, I said the false,
yeah.
the
oh,
myth.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not true. Yeah, it's not true.
I mean, it's
yeah.
it's
there's no weight.
Yeah,
yeah there's
true.
No weight. Yeah, the soul is an energy-based entity. It's energy-based in the sense that it is that part of us that endures forever. And if a soul had mass, if it actually had mass, then everything that Yahweh has told us he's going to do would be a lie. Because you can't infinitely increase mass. You can't, if you have mass, you can't maneuver in time. You would be precluded from doing all the cool stuff in eternity if our soul has mass. It can't have mass. It does not have mass. It's a
well, you could probably tell them something then that they don't know.
Well, it's not because I'm smart. You know, again, if you just go by the basis of Yahweh's really smart, and if he says it, it's true. And I have found that if you go with that, what you find is everything fits. There's no contradictions. All the pieces fit together. It's the same picture. And so, just simply recognize that, you know, that his perspective is that, the nefesh is energy based. It's,
oh yeah, well, you know, and I'm with you because it, the more I know and the more I see things fall into place, okay, even little things, the thing I just brought up with about Abraham, you know, all these things, they fall in, and there's thousands of them,
mm-hmm.
and they all fall in perfect place every time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it'd be one thing if you had a really highly creative
yeah.
writer, okay, which right. in this case we do, but
yeah.
but you know, different parts of script, different parts of Yahweh's words were written by different people.
Correct.
At different times.
Correct.
And to have all this flow in, you know, there was not one book somebody had.
Right.
I mean, we know that. You know, I mean, people don't think of it that way.
1400 BCE, 1450 BCE with the Torah, all the way to around, 450 to 500 with Malachi and Zechariah. That's a long period of time. You know, 1,000 years.
Yeah, it's a
thousand
it's stunning.
Years. Over 1,000 years, you have a story that every single word is consistent. And they tell the same story, and the story is absolutely magnificent. And that the closer you look, the more magnificent the picture is. So it's
right.
exactly
and, the same. But you're talking about people in different eras, different times, writing all these
yeah.
things. They all come together, and like I was saying, everybody looks at it. Today, I mean, people think of it in terms of a book, of a single book,
yeah.
and that's not how they were done.
No, no.
You know, it didn't work out like that.
No. It's
and
a
you're
single
saying
author.
Over 1,000 years, I say from the Torah, you know, it's really a couple thousand years, isn't it? I mean,
well, the Torah was 1450 BCE.
Right.
If you look at
oh no, you're right. Then you go up, yeah, because that's 3,500 years ago, and then
right.
And
you go up to about 450 with
BC. Well, and you could even throw Yao Kanan in there at 69 CE. Actually,
yeah, you could. Although I, you know, I'd
dictated.
You know,
okay.
I. You know,
you wouldn't do that. Yeah. Okay.
If we had a. A Hebrew manuscript of Matanyah, I'd consider it to be equivalent to Bar Rashid. I'd put it side by side with Bar Rashid. If we had a Hebrew manuscript of Matanyah, and I think there's a lot of value in Yahu Kanan too. And I just don't know if it was written in Hebrew, but if there was a Hebrew manuscript of Yahu Kanan, I would, and also of Revelation to Yahu Kanan.
I'm talking specifically about Revelation here because it's dictated.
Yeah,
yeah
dictated.
So,
yeah. If it
you
was
know,
in
I
Hebrew,
mean,
if it was in Hebrew, I would have I'd have a different view. See,
no,
yeah,
I'm not
well,
saying sitting around studying
yeah,
is going to do a
yeah,
lot of good. That's
yeah,
not my point
yeah,
here.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
I said it's
Revelation.
Consistent.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
what I'm saying, you know.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yeah.
It is. You know, again, I wish we had a comprehensive manuscript, and I wish we had it in Hebrew. I will tell you that I've gotten so turned off by Greek as a study tool that the 20 pages that I just did of Paul's experience and his testimony in Acts, I copied and pasted it all out of the New American Standard Bible. I didn't translate
you
a word.
Just got of it. Bored with it. Yeah.
No, it's just that I what if my point was to condemn Paul, then I want to translate Paul's words out of Greek into English. But in terms of trying to understand Yahweh, learning something about Yahweh. By translating Greek, it's just not it's not there. He didn't speak Greek. Greek doesn't represent him. You got to, you know, if you want to understand Yahweh, you got to go to the Hebrew. And so, you know, all I was trying to do with Acts is to prove that Paul was making up the whole story. There was no benefit in translating it out of the Acts out of Greek into English.
You know, Amy just brought up on Unpopular Truth, what about Apophis? And I think she's right. She makes a very good point about us being taken off the earth before that.
Yeah, I think that's highly likely. And Apophis, of course, is Friday, April 13th, 2029, is Apophis. So I would not be surprised if it were 2027. or maybe even 2028.
Yep.
Yeah. It could not be 2029 then if we but you know, keep in mind, Apophis mm-hmm. is no big deal to us. If Apophis were to come in and land on Jacksonville, Florida,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to change your world one iota. You're immediately going to be with Yahweh. So, no big deal. The thing that is going to be tough about the tribulations the last 3.5 years, which is when
you're talking about the persecution
beast.
And
yeah,
so forth.
The beast. Yeah. In Daniel 7 and 8, the beast that is the reincarnation of Rome, Rome through the church, Pauline Rome,
mm-hmm.
that beast's primary enemy is the set apart. It's the children of the covenant.
It's us.
That is
yeah.
his primary enemy, and he is going to persecute and torment and torture and do everything he can to break the children of the covenant. And that's the time you don't want to be here. Dad's not going to let us be here at that time.
No, because there's no point to it. I've heard these people that earn their salvation go on incessantly, and of course they don't call it. They don't even know what Teruah is. They're always talking about, you know, their debate is always post-trib, mid, pre-trib,
right,
or mid-trib,
right,
you know,
right.
trib.
Yeah. But, and by the way, I don't think God even has a word that is trib, a tribulation.
Well, no, I think that's a Greek word, isn't it? And I mean, yeah, it's got nothing to do with anything.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's based on a Greek word. He presents it as a time of Jacob's trouble, and he speaks of great rebellion.
Calamity.
Yeah,
great
it's
calamity.
Really great rebellion. And so it's an extraordinarily rebellious period where there is a period of time that from what I can tell, Yahweh has very little to do with earth. And there's a period of time where he just says, you know, enough already, and I'm going to enjoy the new arrivals in my family, and I'll see you when I on Yom Kippur. But between now and then, you know, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
So, and I don't blame him. But
the whole point is the people that are, you know, I've heard these debates, and I've heard them say, just when Yahweh needs me the most, he's not going to take me. You know, most of them are to the, you know, I'm going to suffer for this 3 years.
I'm going to tell you, Larry, that as many people as we have reached, if we were to disappear tomorrow, God's not going to miss a beat.
No. And by the way, I don't think he needs me to do anything. I mean, the idea that
he wants to do things with you, and he's enjoying doing things with you, and he's happy to do things with you, but he doesn't need us.
That's exactly right. His plan is not predicated on me.
Yeah,
and the very concept.
Although, you know, we may be short-selling ourselves just a bit. He may have, in his plan, calculated that that Richard would have his sight and Don would have his sight, and that you and I would do what we're doing, and that we were all the individuals that he was going to choose to work with.
And that's fine, and I could buy that. But
yeah.
What I can't buy is that Yah was interested in seeing his family suffered and tortured and watched the people they loved die and all the disease and all the rest. And
although I think there will be members of the covenant family that are going to be tortured during the last 3.5 years. They're going to be persecuted. So it is going to be better to have chosen to be part of the covenant before then versus after then.
Because upon the arrival, we see that. I mean,
right.
These people have suffered. I mean,
yeah.
that's not
yeah.
even a question. You're right. You're right.
Right. Right. They're going to be there. People beheaded. There's going to be people tortured. They're going to be condemned. They're not going to be able to buy and sell. They're going to starve. There's going to be 3.5 years where it's going to be absolutely miserable on the members of the covenant family, particularly naturally born Yehudim, who are part of the covenant family.
Yes, yes. But, yeah. But the other thing that I would say about this is that there's a reason that natural born Yehudim are going to suffer the way they suffer, and it isn't for the sake of suffering, it's so they would change their perspectives.
Yeah,
and that's
part,
what
I think part of it is that you're dealing with the last 3.5 years, it's going to be miserable. And that people will reach out and grasp at any lifeline when things are miserable. And what Yahweh doesn't want for eternity, he doesn't want a bunch of people that make it into eternity because, well, they said, well, the persecution is horrible. I think I'm going to reach out and try this God thing to see how it works. And they're really not committed to a life of discovery and of sharing and of learning and being part of the family. So if you know that if I choose the covenant, that I'm not getting myself out of the persecution. The persecution may be greater, but then I'm going to get to spend eternity with Yahweh. Then it changes the dynamics of that choice in the last 3.5 years.
Yeah.
It brings it right back to the Billy Graham thing. If you come forward and you pray for your salvation, that
the sinners
God not playing that game. You know, if you
there
want to
no
know,
sinner,
if you want to be
right.
part of the family, you need to be committed.
Yeah.
It needs to be a priority. It needs to be a priority.
Yeah, well, it is a priority. It is a commitment. You know, sadly, sometimes, I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I think I fall short a lot. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm not committed, you know, when I'm out here working and I'm selling engines all day, okay? I'm committed to making a buck at that moment.
Yeah,
but you know,
your responsibility as a dad, as a husband.
Well, yeah, but one thing, yeah, that's true. You know, and I'm blessed with it. I'll tell you that.
And by the way, you know, all Yahweh said anyway is that he's happy with his children. If we take 6 days a week and we spend those 6 days a week taking care of ourselves and our family, so you know, you're given a lot more than one day a week.
Well.
That's more than he asks.
Well, that's I'm not going to put myself up on any pedestal. You know,
I'm
about the last.
I'm not even
going to
put God up on a pedestal. So if I'm not going to put God on a pedestal, it's for darn sure.
I know you're
not
going
to
put me on no pedestal. I know.
No, I like you a lot.
You're not that foolish.
I'm not putting you on a pedestal. Yeah. In fact, I was going to say today that you know, we were having a discussion about trust and religious people, and I said, listen. I'll go so far as to say the people that I enjoy conversation with and I'm the most comfortable having a conversation with, I said, like Don here right now, like Frank, like Larry that calls in regularly, I would not go so far as to say I trust them. I only trust Yahweh. I don't even trust me. I trust Yahweh. And I've said, yeah, I'm just not going to say it because somebody might misinterpret and say, I don't trust Larry and wouldn't take it the wrong way.
Yeah.
But what we're both saying is we trust Yahweh.
Right. Look, yeah. I've had people tell me that, you know, what are Yada's ulterior motives not to exposing this? I said, he's got no motives.
Yeah.
I said, his motive is to go out there and share Yahweh's words every day.
Yeah.
I said, what are you, crazy? You know, I mean, people get stupid. They really
do.
I mean, you
know, they always have to have an ulterior motive. Yeah,
you know, everybody's got an ulterior motive.
Yeah, I'm spending all this money and time and energy to share Yah's testimony, which makes me vulnerable, which creates all sorts of enemies, and I'm not enjoying the wealth that I've created. I'm not going out and playing golf or flying my airplane or. You know, boating or what, you know, I'm not even spending a lot of time with my family. I'm choosing 60 hours a week to do this. And
yeah, it's an incredible undertaking.
And making nothing for it other than enemies because I've got some ulterior motive. come on. You know, that's one of the reasons why I decided I'm just going to do this as Yada because why not just...
You got enough enemies. Yeah, give Yada the enemy.
Well, it wasn't that. No, it wasn't that. It was, you know, if I do it as Yada, then maybe somebody along the way would say, he's irrelevant. That's, you know, that's how I felt, you know, both of the books
first
now,
of all,
like
that
all
does
three
work
books start off by saying, I'm an irrelevant character here. If you're focused on me, you're really lost before you get started.
Let me tell you something. It works as an advantage to people like me because I can say, look, he doesn't even use his real name. I mean, he's not even looking for adulation, kudos, and all the rest.
You know,
most people are.
Of course.
You know that.
Oh, no, I mean, man. The moment somebody gives you, you know, boy, you're great. I really appreciate what you've done. You go, oh, good grief. No.
That's not what's
going on. Yeah, I'm so comfortable just being a kid in the Covenant family. And let's share what we know from Yahweh. You got no fears, no concerns, no worries.
One of the things that used to bother me, when I walked into churches, you know, I could speak well, I could present myself well.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And they'd come up to me, you got the opening prayer today, you got the closing prayer. And I thought, why do you put me in a position where I'm the representative?
Right.
What are you doing here? You know, I would do it. But I would just feel like, why did you just do that to me?
Yeah. You know, it was the first time I think I really came to recognize that Christianity was a fraud was when I was an elder in a really large church, a 2,500-member church.
Yeah, this is mega church back in the day. Anyway.
Yeah, back in the day. It's not today, but back in our day, it was a mega church. And I was routinely asked to give the opening prayer. And then I would have people tell me how great I was with that prayer.
Yeah, I did that. Yeah, they tell me too. That was wonderful and all this. Yeah.
And then I realize that if you're delivering a prayer that resonates with people, you're talking to the people, not God. But yet you're pretending to talk to God. And I was trying to wrestle with that.
No, you're right.
Yeah,
right.
And I realized, wait a minute, this is a fraud.
No matter
what I'm
how
doing
sincere.
Here is a complete and utter fraud. I'm not worried about how I sound to God. I'm worried about how I sound to these people.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to go up there and just present sincerity and try to be sincere. But I was, of course, at the same time, you have to always be aware you're being watched.
Yeah, but who are you talking to? Yeah,
exactly.
You're talking to the people.
And
I realized, wait a minute,
that's a good point.
This is something seriously rotten in Denmark here. And then finally I realized, you know, I know this drives a lot of people crazy. I don't ask God for favors. I don't.
No, I don't either.
I just don't do it anymore. I mean, occasionally I'll ask him for a favor. I want the favor. I hate Paul. I want to have, and I hate Muhammad. I would like the, and I'm not going to, you know, have a tizzy fit.
You want to be at the court.
I want to be a contributor to both of those two trials. I really
that
do.
That would be incredible. Really.
It's not that I could do a good job. It's just that I realize the pain that they have caused, and I would love to have that privilege. If I don't get it, it's no big deal. But at least I want to be there. Yeah,
you know,
I want
people,
to be there.
People think about all the great things and I think that this is going to have a lot to do with the way Yahweh views our Nephesh, okay?
Yeah, it does.
And I am looking forward to my new name.
Yeah, I
really am. Because that's going to tell me something. You know, it's going to tell me a lot, really.
I'm
going
to
be a wonderful
thing,
and only I'm going to know it.
And
it's probably going to tell me when to step up whenever we're doing something, you know. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I would like that, too.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, everybody thinks about different things they're looking forward to. And I'm looking for, I hate to be so self-centered as to say that.
You're part of the family. You're God's kid. You might as well relax in it. When I think of my place in the covenant, just being one of the kids, I'm a happy camper. A lot of times I'm thinking, I can't wait with the friends and brothers, sisters that we've met here and my son to go off and explore a new solar system.
You know, there's people that are irresponsible. I mean, the vast majority of people are irresponsible. And there's what we would call productive people that are generally pretty responsible people. And I'm not talking about in the covenant or from Yahweh's perspective, but from a worldly perspective. Now, if you take a person who's been responsible, say it's a mother with, raising two kids on her own, and she's made responsible decisions and became, successful moderately or maybe wildly successful, or say it would be somebody like yourself who at one time had, 6,000 employees. Either way, these are awesome responsibilities. And to be in a position where you don't have to be all that responsible. And I mean, I feel like I've been responsible since I could walk. I mean, I'm tired of it, frankly.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know. Yeah. What you're saying is what I feel. I don't want to have responsibility.
Right.
I want to abdicate responsibility. My whole life I've had to be responsible. I don't want to be responsible. That's why I made the deal with Yahweh and said, I'll do this stuff. I'll write these books. I'll do these programs. I'll do the research. But it's your job to promote it because I don't want to be responsible. And it's your job to make certain that you're empowering what we're doing together because I don't want to be responsible. I'm happy to do it. Just don't make me responsible. And he said, okay. I'm happy.
The concept of no responsibility is lovely. We probably will still have responsibilities. But, it won't be like this.
I'm actually hoping that during the millennial Shabbat, that my guess that it's natural-born Yehudim that are given back their part of Yisrael, and that it goes right back to the original idea that the Lowy are going to be interpreting the Torah to govern the millennial Shabbat. I'm really hoping that I have no responsibility. This idea that some people say you're going to have a crown in heaven. How many crowns are you going to have? You're going to be really,
crowns. Pauline thing too?
Yeah, I don't know. But man, I tell you what, all I want to do is get in and be a kid without responsibility. I just want to enjoy the time.
I want to go back to your idea here just very quickly, and I know it's getting late. You're probably going to run to dinner, but here's the situation. You were saying that it's your guess. It's not even a guess at all. You're saying that that there's going to be family, covenant members that suffer the whole 7 years, and I'm talking even outside the land.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're right. Because remember, in Yashayahu, as a gift, those people are brought before Yahweh. You remember that? To Yahweh. As a gift.
Exactly. As a gift.
So, yes. I mean, outside the land, there's going to be some people that suffer that 7 years. And it's horrible.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, but it's interesting that all of our lives we've been responsible, and everybody that's a religious cleric promoting their version of God wants to move up in responsibility and authority. And what we're looking for is to move down in responsibility and authority.
I don't want any responsibility.
But you see, I see all that as being equivalent to the Torah being liberating.
Yeah, well, I also see. I think it was Mose that didn't want to be leading anything, if I recall. And I understand his position too. I really get it. I mean, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how would you like to be herding those cats around?
No.
600,000? No, I don't want. I don't.
No.
I will tell you absolutely. If y'all were to say, I want you to do this job. I might negotiate on the terms and conditions, but I would do the job. I mean, I'd do the job. I know I'd have fun. It'd actually be fun. But quite honestly, the idea of the covenant to me is that we relinquish responsibility.
Yeah.
Once we become the covenant's children, the reason I don't want to worry about my salvation is that's not my responsibility.
No?
It's not.
Well, you got the Torah written inside you. You can't really make a mistake. I mean,
right.
You know,
it's not my responsibility anymore. My responsibility in eternity is to have fun and to have so much fun that occasionally something that we are all doing, having fun together, causes Yahweh to say, "Hey, you know, that's pretty cool. That's fun." I was talking to a
friend of mine today, and I said, "You know, if I was to really, you know, manifest the best parts of my life, I mean, where I was just having the most enjoyment." You know, I was kind of kicked back and just enjoying conversation with friends.
Yeah.
You know, in a real kind of, you know, just a friendly, relaxed environment.
Right. Yeah.
And that hasn't made up a great deal of my life either. Okay.
Yeah.
Not in totality, it hasn't. You know, I don't. I think we're real limited to the good time we have.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Yep, I'm with you on that. That friends and family and great conversation, real conversation. It's not sterile
conversations. Yeah, yeah.
People that you genuinely care about, and you're talking about things that are genuinely interesting, that there's merit to it. Yeah, that's. I would tell you that my most wonderful moments are those things, but they're typically with family.
And they're fleeting.
Friends, but they're fleeting.
They're fleeting.
Yeah, they're fleeting.
Yeah, that's my point.
And that's part of one of the things that I think about a lot with eternity, is that when we are sitting around a campfire and we're all singing and we're sharing and we're telling stories and somebody went off to this solar system, somebody decided that they would examine a lepton or a quark and we're all coming back and somebody found an animal that was just the cleverest thing in the world and they're sharing, they're all just talking about this great stuff that we've explored and we're telling the stories and singing some songs, is the idea that you can take a favorite moment and have it last seemingly forever.
Oh,
do you ever go and see the most beautiful sunset?
You come up with a lepton.
Yeah.
There's probably not many people. That's really small. Sometimes
really
I
small.
Feel like a lepton, pal.
Yeah. Well, lepton to the quark, huh?
I don't know which is smaller.
You're a lepton.
Isn't it
to
a
me?
Lepton that's smaller than a quark, isn't it?
Oh, you know, I think so, yeah. Yeah. Leptons and quarks.
We're out here, man. Every day.
Yeah. Leptons and quarks. All right, Larry. I enjoyed doing this with you. Thank you for participating.
No, I always appreciate it, Yada, really. It's been a pleasure. It's always
a great way
to start my Shabbat.
It is fun. All we're doing is just sharing what we've come to know and love about Yahweh and His covenant. It's good things to do.
Yeah, and we're
all
sharing
right,
leptons and quarks.
Leptons and quarks along the way.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you have a good one. Enjoy your dinner, man.
Okay. Good night.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.